WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Just a month ago, we were riveted by a story about two lawmakers expelled from the state legislature in Tennessee. Their offense wasn't corruption or criminal activity. They had dared to join a protest at the State House in favor of gun control just after the Nashville shooting at a Christian school. And for that, the men who just began their terms in the legislature this year were thrown out.
I don't personally want attention. What I want is attention on the issue of gun violence. But instead, we're here with a resolution you put up talking about expelling me for advocating for ending gun violence in the state of Tennessee.
But those young men are not the only Democrats being targeted by their Republican colleagues. Just weeks later, Representative Zoe Zephyr of Montana was barred from the House chamber for the remainder of the session after making a speech against a trans healthcare ban. In Arizona, Wisconsin, and North Carolina, state legislatures have tried to strip powers from state officials who happen to be Democrats in order to put those powers in Republican hands. Now, debates can get ugly in state legislatures for sure, but these are not exactly debates. They're steps to prevent debate, and they're deeply anti-democratic. So how is this happening and why? I talked last week with the political scientist Jacob Grumbach, who's the author of a book called Laboratories Against Democracy. Jake, in Tennessee last month, we saw two lawmakers thrown out of their seats for joining a protest, which became a big national story. And in Montana this week, a state representative named Zoe Zephyr is suing in an attempt to regain access to the House floor after she gave a speech against restrictions on gender-affirming care. Why are Republicans escalating these seemingly minor confrontations in state legislatures to be national news stories? How does that possibly benefit them?
Right. And one interesting puzzle is these happened in states that have super majorities of Republicans in the legislature. So it's not like eliminating one seat here or there is going to shift a vote on state legislation in these cases. So that's extra interesting. But really what we're seeing is the long culmination of the increasing nationalization of American politics, where state legislatures are at the front line of battling over the national tug of war over issues in the culture war, especially like transgender rights and issues of racial conflict.
Well, how did this happen and why? It must be a deliberate choice on somebody's behalf.
Right. Well, it took sort of major investments by both political parties nationally, campaign donors nationally, and organized interest groups and activist groups over the long term with respect to issues like abortion and reproductive rights or issues of gun rights and gun control. Now we really have two national teams, the Republicans and the Democrats, battling over this tug of war nationally through the institutions of state government.
Is there anybody that's responsible for this strategy? How would you personalize this in Washington, right, on behalf of either the Republican National Committee or the greater Republican Party?
So we can point to, you know, the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers have funded groups like Americans for Prosperity, as well as been, had an arm's length distance, but been sort of involved in the American Legislative Exchange Council. And ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, is an incredibly important organization that really organized three constituencies. That's major business and extractive industry, gun rights libertarians, and the religious right. And what they did is they really provided what we social scientists call legislative subsidies for state legislatures.
Okay, what does that mean?
Exactly. So state legislatures, I don't mean this as an insult, are less professionalized and more amateurish than Congress. They don't have big staff to write bills. They don't have staff lawyers all the time. In some state legislatures, you know, people go into the legislature for maybe a couple months a year, and the rest of the time they're on the, you know, on their corporate board and the American Plastics Council and doing their, you know, earning money. They earn low salaries in the legislature. So what that means is they need help from groups and experts and activists on what to bring on to the political agenda in their states and what bills to write and pass, because that takes serious professional work. And groups like ALEC provided model bills around issues like stand your ground laws that then spread across states, especially Republican-controlled states. But it's not just on the right. You know, you think about climate activist groups and things have really helped the coastal states like California pass fuel efficiency standards and other climate regulations and integrate Democratic state government.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code radiohour at checkout for 15% off.
It's into the national sort of Democratic Party position on climate and the environment.
Now, Jake, I spoke recently with a lawmaker in Nebraska who's been fighting a ban on transgender care in that state. She told me that her constituents don't really care that much about trans issues, and the culture war is kind of out of step with what they do care about, agriculture, property taxes, and so on. That really surprised me. Does it surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. This is part of a larger pattern, and really, a couple generations ago, for better or worse, you know, it's not always great, but states were much more focused on state-based issues and their regional issues. So this could be a bad thing, like in the era of Jim Crow, where this was really about Southern segregationist states protecting the right at the state level to segregate. This was about local public goods and segregated institutions. Whereas now we have what is a national conflict between the parties. Mm-hmm. So an issue like, policies to go after transgender healthcare or rights or things like that, they're not responding to a local influx of transgender rights and trans people, right? This is not responding to a local concern. No,
they're responding to a hot-button culture war thing exactly. That's going to help them possibly in a national election.
Exactly. So if you are a politician and you're trying to rise in the ranks from the local or state level in your party, you have to think about where the donors are, where the organizations in your party network are, and where the national party is. So your best bet is to join the national culture war. So Ron DeSantis is a great example of this in Florida, of really being entrepreneurial, saying, I want to rise in the ranks in the National Republican Party, tap national Republican donors who care about these national issues. And same thing with, you know, Gavin Newsom or, you know, other Democratic governors have responded in kind to tap the Democratic donor base and rise in the ranks and potentially run for president And this is a massive change from a couple of generations ago. And we also have to really emphasize that, unfortunately, voters are really responding to the national tug of war. And we've seen statistically in political science the diminishment and decline of economic voting and voting on the basis of how your area is doing economically or socially, and much more about your sort of national partisanship.
There was a time not so long ago when state-level politics would have been thought of, certainly to, you know, reporters who were aching to go to Washington, as kind of boring. They're concerned with budgets and roads, and that seems to have changed. What's been the effect on the actual day-to-day life of the states? Is if you're spending all your time screaming and yelling at each other about issues that, you know, bear on very few people and are there to impress Fox News or whomever it's there to impress, what's getting lost?
So there's a sort of feedback cycle in the nationalization of political media here, where the internet and the rise of Craigslist really destroyed classified ad revenue for local newspapers that were on the state legislative beat. So there's been a huge decline in state politics journalism. So that makes it harder for voters to hold state-level politicians accountable. And what that means is now voting is really detached from the performance of state legislators and governors on issues like expanding the economy and jobs and, you know, how COVID is doing in an area. And this makes it really hard to have a healthy political system where you bargain over policy when it's sort of national tug of war on these culture war issues where there's really no room to negotiate.
Jake, another tactic we've seen lately is Republican legislatures passing laws to strip power from Democratic officials. In Arizona a couple of years ago, lawmakers stripped Democratic Secretary of State Katie Hobbs' legal authority in election-related lawsuits, and that gave that power to a Republican attorney general. There have been moves quite similar to it in other states, like North Carolina, Wisconsin, Michigan, I think. Is this business as usual, or should we be very alarmed?
That's the key question, David. So I would say the most serious consequence of this nationalization of state politics has been threats to American democracy. The U.S. Constitution puts a massive amount of authority over democracy, over issues like voting rights, legislative districting, and these sort of legislative powers that you mentioned in the hands of states, not the national government. And that's pretty unique, mm-hmm. The U.S. putting all this authority over democratic institutions like election certification at the state level and then to some extent counties. And then the emerging threat of electoral subversion in presidential elections that we almost saw in 2020 and we could see in 2024. And those have been pretty asymmetric. So it is true that Republican-controlled states have passed much more extreme gerrymanders and restrictions on voting. Then there's this additional dimension of it, which is illiberal moves and norm erosion in politics. And that's where you see stripping out partisan governors in Wisconsin and Michigan of power, of transferring power over election administration, and expelling legislators for example, speaking out of turn and things that historically have not generated expulsions.
Jake, you mentioned earlier the Koch brothers, but, you know, this is not the first moment in history when money has played a great role in American politics, either on the state level or the national level. This is not the first time in American history when the politics of the country are deeply fractured and inflamed. So what's new? What about the demographic trends of the country or the rural urban divide of the country have also helped lead us to this place?
So it is true that in the past, threats to democracy and the weakening of democracy in the states was much more extreme. Like we just have to be clear about that. The difference between a Jim Crow and a non-Jim Crow state is so much more vast than the difference between Wisconsin and, you know, Connecticut or something like that. But I think one big difference now is that politics is so nationalized and the Republican Party has kind of uniquely created a coalition of a very elite economic base that prefers high-end tax cuts and deregulation. And then you have the electoral base that's really motivated by anti-immigration politics and other elements of the culture war. That's pretty unique around the world.
Now, I can almost hear a Republican voice somewhere saying, well, wait a minute. Look at politics on the national level. Nancy Pelosi didn't let the Republican Party have its own chosen members of the January 6th committee. In the U.S. Congress, when the House was controlled by the Democrats, Marjorie Taylor Greene was stripped of her committee assignments for views that her opponents found offensive. So what's the difference? Do you think that was a mistake on the Democrats' part in Congress? Or is this an equal battle? How do you assess the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans here?
It's true that the Democratic Party has, for example, used the filibuster against George W. Bush and the Republican Congress. And then again, under Trump, it's true that at the state level, there's been issues with democracy and Democratic states of having elections at the state level be in off cycle, off years in order to keep turnout low. There's all sorts of issues that are challenging for democracy and norms on the Democratic side. But when you just look at them in the aggregate, they don't stack up. So gerrymandering is an easy one where you can quantify the extent of gerrymandering with statistics. And there it's just true that Democratic gerrymanders like in Nevada have not been as extreme as Republican gerrymanders. And then the New York Court of Appeals threw out a Democratic gerrymander. That's Democratic judges threw out a Democratic gerrymander to give Republicans greater advantage in the New York state map. And then in thinking about restricting access to committee assignments and things like that, those are also more minor than the full partisan expulsion of a legislator from a state legislature.
If you look at the issues that the Republican Party is pursuing hardest when it comes to culture wars and other things, you look at abortion restrictions, gun rights. These are broadly unpopular, and they're largely state issues. So even if gerrymandering insulates them to some degree, isn't there a danger for the Republican Party of overreach and seeing these issues come back to hit them in the back of the head?
That's right. Going too far, absolutely, has been backfiring. And in 2022, we saw, somewhat surprisingly, that heavy sort of fear-based tough-on-crime appeals, plus transgender panic around bathrooms, plus the abortion issue have actually not been as successful as one might have thought for the Republican Party.
So what's the fix here? Are there states that are doing things better?
So, yes. So the average state in terms of its democratic health, small d democracy, has actually been okay. That's because some states like where I am now, Washington State, Colorado, and others have really expanded access to voting and have independent redistricting commissions that have really drawn fair districts for both parties. So every voter has an equal say in setting a state legislative or U.S. congressional majority. And then I really think we as social scientists, economists, political scientists, sociologists have understated the role of labor unions and organized labor in keeping Americans, especially working class white Americans, also Latino men, away from the culture war and towards a politics of what are the policies that are going to help my family materially? And that's a much healthier politics.
Jacob Grumbach, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Jacob Grumbach teaches political science at the University of Washington, and his recent book about state politics is called Laboratories Against Democracy. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come.
Hi. I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour. Radio Hour, and use the code Radio Hour at checkout for 15% off. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Joshua Yaffa has reported from Russia for a decade. He covered the country's tragic slide toward dictatorship under Vladimir Putin. And recently, Josh filed a piece that was quite unusual for him, a very personal story. The Russian government arrested a friend of his, Evan Gershkovich, a fellow journalist who was reporting for the Wall Street Journal.
Russia's security agency says it has arrested a U.S. journalist working for the Wall Street Journal in Moscow on charges of...
The charge against Gershkovich was espionage, quite obviously a false charge. For years, Putin has been suppressing Russian journalists, closing down one outlet after another, even as foreign correspondents were still able to report the news freely. But the arrest of Evan Gershkovich is the first time the Kremlin has imprisoned an American reporter supposedly for spying since the 1980s. What was once a tactic of Cold War politics has returned under Vladimir Putin. I spoke last week with Joshua Yaffa. Josh, when did you first hear this horrible news about Evan?
It would have been, I guess, the day after we now know he was arrested in Yekaterinburg. I woke up to the news going around Telegram channels, Twitter, that American reporter had been arrested in Russia. Quickly, it became clear that American reporter was Evan, and then began the frantic texts with friends, colleagues, our circle of people who know Evan, were close to him. From Moscow and beyond, trying to figure out, frankly, what the hell had happened.
Now, the first time Evan was seen publicly after that was a few weeks later when he appeared in court with his lawyers.
Yeah, because it's Russia, he was brought to something called the akvarium, this kind of glass cage where defendants are held during court proceedings. And so there were these pictures and video of our friend Evan in the aquarium. And it was painful and outrageous, frankly, to see him that way. But also, it was just so surreal. I mean, how many times has Evan, how many times have I, how many times have we all been in a courtroom with our notepads out, looking at someone in the aquarium and writing our story about yet another political case, yet another act of political repression against the Kremlin's enemies?
It's always seemed to me that there is a similar closeness and competitiveness and a kind of community among the pretty few foreign correspondents that are there. Just what was the life like in Moscow, and what was your relationship with Evan like?
Well, I moved to Moscow in 2012. Evan came in 2017, full of ideas, energy, ambition, a really fun guy, nice guy, really into journalism, really into Russia. He has this legacy, family legacy from his parents who emigrated to the U.S. in the 1970s.
Did he grow up speaking, Did he grow up speaking Russian in the house?
Yeah. He spoke Russian in the house, a kind of funny Russian, a bit frozen in amber that he had to kind of de-thaw. He's much more a student of Russian slang. Maybe it's the fact that he's, you know, a few years younger than me, hung out with a younger, cooler crowd of people in Moscow. But I envy how quickly he integrated.
Where did people hang out?
Gosh, I mean, that's the thing about Moscow, too, in this sort of late, you know, pre-war period, is that it actually had the trappings in a quality of life sense as like a fun happening almost European city, right? I mean, or the illusion of that was really available. So you had like great bars, great parks, like a food scene that was really developing. The Michelin Guide had an event in Moscow launching the first ever Russian rankings of Michelin restaurants in Russia. There were these people, you know, making exquisite Michelin food with Sakhalin crab and, you know, caviar and reindeer from Karelia. And
fantastic.
It's not that Ivan and I were eating reindeer every night, but still, the point is, Moscow, especially for a young, funny, happening, smart, charming guy like Evan in your late 20s, was just a cool place to live. And he was excited about being there, not just because he liked banya and bars, but because
being steam baths where you get hit by eucalyptus branches and all the rest.
Right. Where you have to go clean out those toxins after a night in Moscow bars. I remember understanding early on for me, this is before even Evan came to town, that Moscow might be my kind of town, when shortly after I arrived, I was invited to a press breakfast, and the hour that it was called for was noon.
But that's typical.
Right, right. So but it's also the place where, you know, people are still working at 9 p.m. and, you know, meet for dinner and drinks at 10 p.m.
Josh, what was Evan reporting in those years as the Putin government was moving more and more toward autocracy?
Well, I think he had a really deep and nuanced sense of Russia. He was very clear-eyed, as we all were, about like the big macro-level political trajectory of Russia. He covered the story of protests in the summer of 2019, in which people were chased around the streets of Moscow by riot police. He was both, you know, deeply embedded with the opposition, but knew people across Russian society. I mean, he was covering that story and knew all about it. But he also found the interest to find other stories, like going to Udmurtia, a region I still can't pronounce apparently all that well in Russia, where he wrote about dying languages, the last speakers of some indigenous languages in remote parts of Russia, and the way that these people were fighting after the Soviet legacy and the Putin one to keep these languages alive at great difficulty and cost to themselves. And that, I remember, is just such a great Russia story. Anyone can come and do the Moscow protests story, the big political story, Navalny and so on, right? But you have to know the place, care about it, and have this vision, is the word that keeps coming to mind for me, of being able to sort of scan the horizon and see, oh, that's happening and that's a story and I know how to do it.
Were you ever in a competitive story with Evan?
I remember this would have been the summer, I guess, of 2021, when there were big, huge wildfires in Yakutia for a while, right? Like this was the story of the moment, of course, now in the context of the war.
In the Far East, yeah.
Right, yeah, deep in Siberia. And this was like the big story in Russia, these incredibly destructive forest fires with huge implications, actually, just not for Russia, but for the planet. And I was working on a story set in Yakutia at the same time. My story had more to do with permafrost, also affected by fire, but not quite the same thing. But Evan was really dedicated to writing about these fires and their impact on local communities. You have to have a specific idea of fun to think that going up in Soviet era, like propeller planes flying through wildfire smoke, is like a good time that you're jealous on having missed out on. But Evan was up there with the firefighters, going to these, landing at these remote airstrips, camping in the fields with them, actually, under incredible heat with smoke. I remember at the time, I was also in Yakutia, but here I am looking at like ground that's taking a millennia to thaw. I mean, it's not the most dramatic thing to look at a bunch of soil that, I mean, supposedly it's the implications are, they are quite dramatic, but it's, you know, it doesn't have the same adrenaline. And it's not just about adrenaline. I mean, he got really visceral, important first-person journalism.
Josh, eventually, like you and a lot of other journalists who were based in Moscow, Evan ultimately had to leave Russia. But he still did some reporting from inside the country during the war.
Yeah, he went back over the summer for a reporting trip. He went back for another reporting trip. And that's the way he and others in the Western press corps who continued to report from Russia worked, going in on reporting trips and writing stories that were really deep and revelatory and tactile, and I think brought to light in a way that I just, as a reader, found really interesting. I remember a story he did from Pskov in northwestern Russia a town that is home to a number of military units that suffered extraordinarily heavy losses in Ukraine. And he found a city that was scared and traumatized, but also in a very macabre way, had come around to convince itself of the merit of the war, that was telling itself a narrative about the war's virtue, its importance. And Evan wrote a really moving and dark and disturbing but important story from Pskov. And he was able to do that kind of work. Evan was not sanguine or Pollyannish or naive about the context in which he was working. He understood this was a very different Russia than the one he had arrived to in 2017. I mean, he understood that the climate for journalism had become much more fraught. But still, within that, there was no reason to think that foreign journalists would be targeted by Russian law enforcement. We could cover the Navalny protests. And there was even some cases where foreign journalists were swept up by the riot police and thrown in a police van from the streets covering these protests. But usually by waving a foreign press card at the police, you were let out and you could go on your way. And so it felt like, you know, rightly or not, it was almost kind of an uncomfortable privilege to have. And for all that time, the precedent held that somehow Western reporters were safe. The worst thing that could happen to them was their visa might not be renewed. You know, they would be kicked out of the country, forced to, or barred from entering Russia to report. So this clear violation of precedent, a really escalatory step, obviously contains a very strong kind of message of political intent on the part of the Kremlin, and I think Putin himself. You know, the rules have changed. We're still left guessing at what this all means and what we're supposed to understand by it. But this is such a dramatic break from precedent that it doesn't happen accidentally.
I was the same age he was when I was in Moscow. And I can't imagine the fear that my parents would have felt if I were in Lefortovo prison, a notorious prison. And there is your son in the midst of this horrific political situation in which Putin is using your son as trade bait. You've talked to Evan's parents, I know. What is their life like? And what is their sense of what Evan's life is like inside of Lefortovo prison?
Of course, it's fear of the unknown, fear of what is Evan's life like right now, like right in this very second, right? Mm-hmm. How is he doing? How is he feeling? Will there be a trial? How long could that take? Will there be a trade, what everyone is pointing to and speculating about? How long can that all take? And I think that all that uncertainty, of course, is really crushing for, or can be for a parent. But I also want to say that they have real dignity and bravery and courage in facing this and doing what they can to support their son and try and get him home and to keep themselves sane and strong in the process.
Josh, if you could get a message to Evan, what would you tell him?
I hope, get messages to Evan. I've been sending him letters. I tell him how proud I am of him. Of course, how worried I am about him, but mainly how impressed, if that's the right word, I am in how he's handling the situation with dignity, courage, humor of all things, right? I mean, somehow the strength of Evan's character is such that he's finding ways to crack a smile, even crack a joke. All I can do, and that's what I've also told Evan in these letters, is to just talk about him wherever I can on this podcast for The New Yorker, a piece I wrote the day after Evan was arrested, and keep his name in people's minds, in the minds of people in Washington, so that everyone knows and Evan knows that we're waiting for him to come home, and hopefully that in some way gets him home a little bit faster.
Josh Yaffa, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
Joshua Yaffa is a contributing writer at The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Burkhard Bilger's writing for The New Yorker has covered a wide, wide landscape, from rodeos to cave exploration, from Mars to southern food, music, neuroscience, almost everything. On Burke's long list of stories, every page contains a kind of universe. But over the last few years, nearly a decade, Burke has been researching a subject much closer to home. He's been looking at the history of his own family. He grew up in Oklahoma, the child of German immigrants, and his new book is about their generation, and it's called Fatherland, a memoir of war, conscience, and family secrets.
Well, my parents are both what you call Kriegskinder, as you say. So they were born in 1935.
What does that mean? Children
of? Kriegskinder means children of war.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that they're in an interesting spot psychologically. They were, you know, very young children during the war. And they carry, I think, the guilt of the war within them. And at the same time, they aren't responsible for anything. So this is kind of you're in between two.
There's no question of
emotions.
Agency.
There's no question of agency. And so it was something they talked about, but they didn't really go into detail about. My grandfather was in the Nazi party, and my mother would acknowledge that, but we would never really go into any detail about it.
Burke, I have to tell you that even now, it's a startling thing. I remember when we were editing this piece and the pictures started appearing, there was a picture of your grandfather in the obvious uniform, and it was startling for me to put together this guy who I worked with now for years and I have great affection for and enormous regard for as a writer. And then there's his grandfather in a Nazi uniform. Tell me a little bit about him and how you think about him and how I should think about him.
My grandfather was a school teacher in Aulfing, a little village in Germany, and he was in his late 30s when the war started, and he was a fervent Nazi party member. And at a certain point, he was sent to a village in Alsace called Bautenheim as part of the German campaign to re-educate these young French students and turn them into good Germans now that they were part of the German Reich. But the fact that he was a Nazi didn't really come into our family conversations until I was late in my teen years. And my mother always talked about it as he had been sent there, but she never talked about what he did. And I think she herself, even though she'd written her dissertation on the German occupation in France, she never looked into that history. And so it was kind of this blank
spot.
Because
it was unbearable for her?
I don't know if it was unbearable. I think she was scared to find about what she would find out. She was scared to look into that hole. And then finally, late in the day after she'd handed in her dissertation, she went there and she discovered actually that there was more to the story, that he had been a fervent Nazi party member, but then he had eventually collaborated with the head of the resistance in the village. And there'd been a trial or an investigation for a trial, and eventually had been exonerated, and the villagers had kind of come forward to defend him. So it suddenly became a much more complicated story. And I went, I think, from having this guilty embarrassment in my family history to having something that intrigued me and confused me. Like, how could a person be both those things?
At what point did this taboo start breaking up in Germany and you started talking about the war in traumatic terms? When did Germans feel that this was even possible?
It's only been in the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, people often talk about how it really began with the work of Sabine Bode, who did a lot of interviews with Kriegskinder and has written three books of oral history about them.
She's a historian or psychologist?
She's a journalist by trade and married to a psychiatrist, and she put these books together, and they kind of broke open the box. And I asked her how she got onto this big subject and what drove her to it.
It started more than 20 years ago in the Balkan War. You know, TV showed the children suffering. And one day, as I'm a journalist, I asked myself, so what about the German war children? Must be, they're now getting pretty old or not. Or why I never heard about them? Why did I never hear how they coped with that fate? You know, what kind of silence is that? And at the beginning, I thought, well, that's an interesting story for me. I worked at the radio station at that time for the audience, and nobody was interested.
Was there a fear? I mean, I know that there's a resistance to talking about German trauma and German suffering during the war, because, of course, the Germans inflicted so much suffering on the rest of the world during the war. Is that why the radio station wasn't interested back then, do you think?
Yes. And at that time, all the editors in the radio stations or in the newspapers or the people in charge, they belonged to that age group, you know. So I had to wait for a change of generation that people said, oh, yeah, that's interesting. Why don't you make a piece for me? That's about my parents.
Right, right. So what was your first experience going out and trying to collect stories from Kriegskinder, asking them about their experience during the war and so forth?
Well, there was one thing, the way they spoke. It was either, oh, it was a funny time, we had a lot of good times, and it was a lot of adventure. And they told all those stories. Actually, some stories were really funny, I must say. Or it was completely without emotion, you know, like somebody is reading something in a telephone book. The numbness remained for many of them until they got old.
Right, right. I want to ask you a little bit about your own background. I mean, you had done some of your own research into your family history and war history as well, right? Was that one of the things that led you into this field?
No, I had it already done when I did it. And it helped me because I had my personal peace with my family story.
Do you mind talking about that a little bit? How did you start your family research, and what did you know when you started?
Well, I knew my father was a Nazi. I knew my mother was a Nazi. Everybody knew because they talked like Nazis almost until they died. There were these people who said, well, the way I talk about that time, everybody thinks like that, but they just don't dare to say that anymore. My father felt like a hero in a way that he was so courageous to say what he thought. And nobody stopped him as far as I remember as a teenager. It was very embarrassing for me. Yes.
What kind of things did he say when you say the way he spoke? What kind of things would he say that were classic old Nazi thoughts?
Yeah, well, what they all said, it wasn't all bad. You know what Hitler did? He should have stopped earlier, something like that. He wasn't quite sure if the Holocaust happened or not, at least not to that extent, not with these millions he just couldn't believe.
And so then you thought, you wanted to look into his own history as during the war, or his father's history, or what did you then research after that?
Well, since it wasn't much they told us, and after a while, but I was only able to do that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, because only then we had access to the archives we needed.
Do you mind talking about what you found, what the background history was that you discovered?
Well, he and my grandfather betrayed a Jewish relative. He was the husband of the sister of my grandfather. He tried to hide as a Jew, and my father and my grandfather together helped the Gestapo to find him. He was murdered in Auschwitz.
Right. So what was it like to discover that? Could you describe the moment when you found that evidence in the archives, how that felt?
I tell you, it was a relief because I thought, oh, that something like that in way of that he was not a mass murderer. So what it did confirm me in what I always suspected and what I carried with me and said, well, listen, yeah, okay, that's the way it is. That was him. And all the relatives lied to me. That was really not nice. That was not nice to think of that over. That he kept silent and my mother's, well, that is easily to understood, but all the relatives did the same.
So you had always suspected that he had done a war crime, but you'd been afraid that it would be something even more terrible than what he did.
Yeah. My generation, born after the war or in the end of the war or in the 50s, we all thought that was our main fear. Was my father a mass murderer?
When you say it's a relief, it's interesting. I know, when I was researching my own grandfather's history, which is ambivalent. I mean, there's evidence that he did almost courageous things during the war, and then obviously he was a Nazi party member and was in occupied France, he must have also countenanced terrible things or allowed things to go by if not participated in. I don't know.
You know, we all come from these families. Why do you always put questions? You don't know anything. Keep quiet. Keep silent. Da 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 da. Yes, but your insight still has these questions. And then after a while, you say, "Oh, I was right. That's a very good feeling. I was right." Yes.
You and your brothers are very slightly apart. I mean, they were alive during the war. You were not. Could you talk a little bit about that? What was the difference between being a Kriegskind to being a Nachkriegskind, as you would be called?
I guess the main thing is when they were very small children, when they were just born in the first 1, 2, 3 years, they had parents and they had an environment of adults which felt stressed all the time, you know. Whereas me, I belong to the generations with the lowest rate of newborn. I must say, when my early remembers is, you know, I walk out the house and I'm maybe 3 years old or 2.5, and every adult which meets me stops, says, "Hello, how are you, Sabina? Nice to meet you."
They were just so happy to see children.
Yes, I was carrying the hope, you know, for a better life.
You know, it's funny. That's very much my first memories. Strong memories are being 5 years old. We moved to Germany, to Karlsruhe, when I was 5 in 1969. And my mother would take me on her shopping rounds every day. And every store we went to, the shopkeepers were so kind, and they would give me a candy, a gummy bear, or they would give me a piece of German sausage, or they would, you know, there was, and it was that same. There did seem to be this hunger for youth and innocence and children in Germany, even
later. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Can you tell me a couple stories from people that really stuck out for you, that people told you about the kind of trauma they experienced, or stories that might have, things that happened to them that might have traumatized them during the war?
The strongest one I had, and it's about a woman, and she practically, the whole war, she was sitting in the air raid center. She was, that was a harbor city, and it was bombed from the beginning to the end of the war. I mean, it was incredible what she said, that one day she missed the shelter because she wasn't fast enough running to school. And then the alarm came and she wasn't fast enough and the doors of the bunker was closed. And then she was there alone, completely alone. You can't believe it. And in that bombing, and she said afterward, "I never told anybody, because I was scared they would tell me, why didn't you hurry up?" And at the same time, her mother was a person, she wanted her to be a happy child. And she said sometimes, "Why can't you be happy?" You know. And this woman had a handicap, developed a handicap, and only very late, I think she was more than 70, she realized that came from her war childhood. She was so forgettable. She was so extremely forgettable. She forgot everything, good things, bad things.
It was her short-term memory that she, like her recent memories?
And long-term, both. And then she started to reconstruct her childhood. And it was quite a process. And what happened, the long-term memory got better and the short-term memory got better. And she was enjoying her age then because she said, you know, "I love learning. And it was always hard for me to learn because I couldn't keep things in mind so well. And now I'm learning all the time.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, there's certainly people who will say, why should we care about German suffering in the war? You know, again, there was so much terrible things were done by Germans. Why should we care about the suffering of the Kriegskinder? What do you say to them? What do you feel about that?
I say, sorry, it is not only in Germany. I think we find the same stories in Poland and in Russia. We find them in Cambodia. We find them in South America. That is an universal issue. Of course, it varies from the history, from what happened, what kind of atrocities, how many victims, how many perpetrators. Okay, but parents cannot bear the thought that they were not able to protect their children. They're happy when children never mention that again. You know, then they think everything is fine. We have a strong resilience. Everybody of us has, I guess, or most of us have. But when you don't know that you are traumatized, then it is hard to overcome.
Right, right. Let's talk a little bit about Familienaufstellung, this type of group therapy. I mean, I was fascinated to discover how popular this type of group therapy is in Germany, and it seems to be I'll quickly describe it. It's a type of group therapy that people often use to explore their family history. And what you do is you spend a day or two in a room with 10 other strangers, and each of you takes turns talking to the therapist for a while and talking about what you're feeling, what your problems are, and a bit about your family history. And then the patient chooses strangers from the room to represent family members from their history. And those strangers then proceed to kind of almost channel the spirits of those people they've been asked to represent. They have dialogues, they suddenly have memories of things they did during the war, and often new information arises that they'll say, oh, I can sense that I was, I was molested by Russian soldiers during the war, they might say, or these new things come up. And it's become very popular in Germany, and it seems like a way in which people often explore the past when they can't discover the things they wanted to discover in the archives, or their parents didn't tell them what happened.
I don't know if it is a therapy. You know, it may be an initiation to start, yes? My mother, for instance, had a brother, and he died in the war the last day. She hardly ever talked about him, and it was her dearest brother. That kind of thing is that I sometimes call the ghost of the death. Yes, it is not something which you can solve, you know, with that. It can help you to start to get interested in your family story. I don't believe in healing by that. I believe in healing, I think, is a long process. I mean, war doesn't end when the weapons are silent, but war does infect narrow relationships, you know. That is why so many people of your age group are visiting Familienausstellung. And some of them wish that this is, you know, you get out and you are free. That doesn't work.
Right.
But it starts. I don't know if it's the one you attended. It was the same. There's a lot of crying. There's a lot of mourning.
Yes.
And that is helpful.
Sabina Baudet talking with The New Yorker's Burkhard Bilger. Burke has just published the book Fatherland, a memoir of war, conscience, and family secrets. I'm David Remnick, and that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbes of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.